Right here to the Paranormal View on the Parex Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us tonight, those in the chat room and those listening from around the world. We appreciate each and every one of you. If you do have questions tonight, you can private chat them either to Henry Foister or Ceiling Cat, and we will get those answered for you. And if you're listening from somewhere else other than here in the chat room and you'd like to join us, feel free to come over to para-x.com and click on the chat now button at the top of the page. You'll be in with all these wonderful people, and you'll be able to interact with them and ask questions of our guest. Also, if you do not want to come in chat room, but you have questions, you can email those to theparanormalview@gmail.com, and we will get those answered for you. Tonight, we've got a great guest. It sounds like we got a little bit of feedback. So,
yes,
I'm not sure what end that's coming in
I'm
on.
Not hearing it.
You don't.
If I listen closely, I can actually hear my voice down a delay coming back to me in a great distance.
And I have no idea what's causing that. So, anyway, with that, we have Jeffrey Gould with us. We have Barbara Duncan with us.
I'm here.
And Jeff, you got the bio. I'll let you introduce our guest. How's that sound?
Well, tonight's guest is folklorist author Alan Brown. He's a professor of English as well as the director of Center and Contemporary Writing Program at University of West Alabama in Livingston. Alan Brown has written numerous books. I counted about 20. He says about 30. I'll have to check on that. On the oral ghost narratives in the South. So welcome, Alan Brown.
Well, thank you. I actually have lost track of how many I've written.
Hate when that happens.
Well, once I write one, as far as I'm concerned, it's done. I'm done with it, and then I go on to I focus on the next one, and so I guess that's why I lose track of them.
Okay.
Well, I hope you don't forget what you write.
Actually, I do.
Write the same book again.
Well, I spent most of the day going over my latest book, which I actually wrote over a year ago. So my mind gets a little fuzzy. I'm getting old. That's part of the reason. So my mind's getting a little fuzzy on some of the details.
You know, there's that no erased data in your brain, so you know sometimes it just gets full.
That's right.
Yeah. That's what I keep telling myself anyway.
It's funny the things you remember and the things you can't remember that you should be able to remember, like my wedding anniversary.
Oops.
Or in my case, why I walked into this room. It was a lot of happens. You know. You're like, oh man.
Yeah. Embarrassing.
Now go ahead, Barbara.
No, I was just gonna say okay.
Oh. There's a lot that's in this book. You don't just talk about like some of the haunted mansions, but you talk about haunted colleges and haunted buildings and haunted locations. So there's quite a bit in the book. I guess one of the first questions that I would ask is, have you been to most of these locations, or how'd you gather up all the information?
Yes, I have been to at least three-fourths of them. And most of the information I've gotten is from interviews I've conducted with people on site, or some cases telephone interviews. And some of this I've got from books. Of course, I've used the internet some as well, as we all do, I guess, these days, because it's so easy. I really try to get in touch with people who have had firsthand experiences. I think those make the most compelling reading. If you say, I had this happen to me on this date, as opposed to just a second or third hand story, which I have had to rely on in some cases.
How willing are people to talk to you about their paranormal investigation or paranormal incidents?
Well, I'll tell you, it has become a lot easier to collect ghost stories from people after 2005 when the TV series Ghost Hunters came on. I'm not a huge fan of it. I did watch it religiously, I will admit, because they went to a lot of places I've been to. But nowadays, it's really not a sign of shame to admit that you've had a ghostly experience or a paranormal experience that you can't give a rational explanation for. And people are more forthcoming with their stories. It also helps that, well, in the case of the Alabama book, I travel around the state with the Alabama Humanities Foundation. I give lectures. And I have given lectures on folklore, on ghosts, on death lore. And so there's some name recognition that also helps me secure interviews with people. And I guess they figure if I'm a college professor that therefore I must be on the up and up, which is not necessarily true.
But it does lend a little bit of credence to the research of being able to, you know, and paranormal investigations or paranormal research really isn't that commonplace anymore. Most people want to investigate, but nobody really wants to do the background stuff.
Well, I almost became a history major. I love history. And so I always begin my stories, I preface them with the historical background, because I think that enhances the chills that you get when you read these accounts, personal accounts that might be apocryphal, might not. You know, you've got that line between fact and fantasy there, and it's at that point where the goosebumps rise on your arm, where you say to yourself, well, maybe this did happen. This could have happened. Maybe this could have happened to me if I was in this old house at this particular time. And so that's what I go for. And being a professor, I want to educate people and entertain them at the same time. So I guess that's how I justify all the time I spend on this. And it does take a lot of time. But my children are grown, and I actually had to wait until they left the house before I could really get serious about this, which has become a hobby, I guess. I couldn't live off what I make from my books. I have a real job. But I may be retiring from it fairly soon, and in which case I could devote myself entirely to writing.
Now, the places that you have, you did a lot of research on the houses and stuff, the history of it. And I thought it was a fascinating story on this one, the Beaver's House in Cuba. It's got a real fascinating story. Would you like to?
Oh, yeah. That's a terrible story. Well, it was originally a plantation house built in the 1850s. And in the 1970s, there was a 69-year-old woman who lived there. She was a music teacher, piano player, organist. She had just come home from a church social, turned on the lights. I'm not even sure she got to turn the lights on. She walked in the front door, and there were two guys inside her house. They had escaped from a prison in Oklahoma. And one of them grabbed her and slit her throat in the doorway. And the blood soaked into the wood. Well, they robbed her. They took what they could and escaped. They eventually killed them in a shootout. This would have been 1971, I believe. The people who own the house now, the Munozes, Linda and Charlie Munoz, very sweet people. And they're very artistic, so they have a lot of parties at the house. Some of their guests have smelled lilac perfume, which is an old scent. They've heard sounds. There was actually a colleague of mine who stayed there, Linda's his aunt, and he stayed there for about a month, and he went there late at night to get some internet equipment, and he felt cold. In fact, he hadn't even turned the lights on. He felt cold. At the same moment, the Munoz's dog started barking outside, and he hightailed it out of there really fast. And this guy is an experimental psychologist, and he does not profess a belief in spirits, but he insists that he can't explain what happened to him there. And those are the kind of interviews I love. You know, there are some people who want to believe in ghosts. They want to see ghosts. And sometimes I think they talk themselves into believing this. But this guy didn't want to believe it. And I'm really surprised he let me use his story because of that. But beautiful home. It doesn't look like the Munster's house. Doesn't look like a haunted house at all. But there have been people who've gone there who have felt uneasy. But Stacy Beavers is not a malevolent spirit by any means. And I would guess that, I don't know, I guess there is some kind of emotional attachment to the house, because she did love it and restored it herself. Well, there's another incident that occurred that is actually kind of funny. They had a Halloween party there one night, and they had a friend of theirs was playing ragtime on the piano, and Linda had some of the kids up in the little Belvedere up the top. They were stargazing, and they heard this crashing sound, and they ran down the stairs, and a big cabinet. A big cabinet with a glass door had fallen over. It had never done that before. And the glass, for some reason, the glass didn't break. It never happened again. And Linda told me she thinks it happened because Stacy Beavers didn't like ragtime music and objected to it being played on her piano. So that's why she pushed the thing over.
Wow.
Well, it sounds reasonable.
Reasonable.
Everybody's a music critic. Yeah. but you know, it brings to a question of how many people, and does it lend more credibility to the fact that they don't want to believe in ghosts and are coming forward with these stories? About how many people in your books honestly don't believe it, what they witnessed or saw?
Well, I would say the majority of them probably are leaning toward believing before these things happen to them. But then I have some that really are very logical, level-headed, rational people. My wife is one of these. She is a retired math teacher. She actually offsets me since I'm the English professor. But she's the one that has all the ghost experiences when we go to these haunted bed and breakfasts and haunted restaurants. I don't. I want to have them. And all these things happen to her, which is kind of ironic in a way, because she is so level-headed. And people tend to believe her when they tell her, "This happened to me, and I can't explain." I'll give you a good example. We went, also about 5 years ago, we were in Key West, Florida, and we went to a bed and breakfast called the Artist House. And we were asleep on the second floor, and this was in the summertime, so Marilyn had her feet sticking out from under the covers, And she said during about 2 o'clock in the morning, the door opened. She heard footsteps come in, and someone or something pulled the covers over her feet. And then she heard the footsteps exit the door. And these things happened to her so much, she really wasn't scared. She was more intrigued by it. Well, that same then, she told me the story. It was about 8 in the morning. So I reached over for my glasses from the nightstand, and where I always put them, and they were gone. And I looked all over that room. I couldn't find them. I was getting frustrated. So I pulled my suitcase out and was going to pack it, and my glasses were underneath the suitcase. There's no way I would have put my glasses under the suitcase.
Yeah, seriously.
So, and I have no rational explanation for that. But like I say, people are more likely to believe her than they are me, because I do spend so much time with this subject. And I really like Edgar Allan Poe, too, and I like horror movies. That sort of thing. But I had a one of my favorite ghost stories came from our bookkeeper at our auditor at UWA at the university. I teach at University of West Alabama, and he his name was George Snow. He died last year. George told me that he was getting ready for an audit, and he was in a building that used to be a girls' dormitory. There were three fires there, and the last one was 1915. They rebuilt it in 1916. He was in his he was in his office, which is at the end of a long corridor on the second floor, and he's all by himself. It was 9 o'clock at night. He was thirsty. Opened the door, started to walk down the hall. Immediately smelled, again, lilac perfume, that old scent. And he looked down at the end of the hallway, and he said he caught a sight of what he described as a flash of petticoats walk across the end of the doorway. Well, he said he decided he had done enough work for that for the evening. He took off. He went home. He never saw the apparition again, but he had smelled, he did smell the perfume, and the comptroller had a similar experience, brought his children there, his daughter and her friends. It was during about one of the breaks, I think a Christmas break about 6 years ago, and all the girls smelled it. And he hadn't, his name's Lawson Edmonds, and Lawson hadn't told them about the ghostly smells, but they smelled it. They all smelled it. And so here we have business types, again, who are not highly imaginative people, but who have these experiences. And that's what I love it when those people tell me these stories.
Wow. It's also fun when people have paranormal experiences and don't realize it's a paranormal experience until later.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that's shocking to them, and it's shocking to the reader, too, and if you describe it correctly, mm-hmm. as just a mundane event that doesn't really have any paranormal overtones until you get to the end of it, and then, oh, my God, there it is.
Yeah.
This was really a ghost I was talking to, let's say. And,
You mentioned your university. How haunted is your university?
Oh, it's haunted enough that I give ghost tours.
Cool.
I give ghost tours at the university and the town. Now, Livingston, Alabama is very small. So we start at the what they call the Board Well. Livingston used to be a resort town. It has a spring. So we start there, and then we walk through the historic part of town. It was settled in the around 1835, and so we walked through there. Then we go back to the campus, and we walk around it. And yeah, we have all kinds of haunted places there. Last fall, the student affairs office promoted the heck out of my annual ghost tour that I give on Halloween. We had over 200 people there. It was amazing.
Wow.
But by the time I was done, my throat was raw. I should have brought a microphone, but I didn't, so I had to scream
for an hour and a half. Jar of honey while you're at.
Yeah. I'm going to definitely bring a microphone this year. Livingston is very haunted. And there are a lot of little old forgotten towns that used to be important in some cases when a railroad passed through, but aren't important anymore. And a lot of those little towns are haunted.
Wow.
And I love going to those places and getting their stories.
Now, you talk about this one place in Tuscaloosa. Mm-hmm. I thought the story was pretty interesting because there was some tragedies in the house, but it's called the Drish House. And,
oh, yeah.
The guy had, like, he had, I guess, there's a lot of death in the house. So what is ghost stories there?
Well, that's one of Alabama's most famous ghost stories. And I'll give you a little background here on our ghost stories. There was a woman named Catherine Tucker Windham, who was also a journalist. She actually did a lot of good work during the civil rights movement here in, she was based in Selma, so she covered the conflict in Selma. But she wrote in the late 60s, early 70s, she wrote a series of books about Alabama's ghosts. And so she inspired me to start doing it myself. I actually knew her, and I used to bring her to our folk, from Selma to our folk festival every summer. And the Drish House is one of her stories. And she does a wonderful job telling it. I went to the Drish House. I talked to the woman who is the director of the Drish House, and she pretty much verified the printed version. Although you've got to be careful of printed versions of stories, because some writers take liberties with the facts, and Windham was pretty good about sticking to them for the most part. And according to her version, Dr. Drish was he was a gambler, he was a drinker, he pretty much ruined life for his family, especially his long-suffering wife. The house itself is beautiful. It is a fine example of Greek Revival architecture, and it was built in the 1850s. And he was, the Civil War ruined him, as it did so many people, and he really took to drinking after the war. He lost about everything, and in 1867, he became delirious, staggered out of bed, tried to go down the stairs, fell midway down, and died just a few hours after that. Now, the Drish House has a tower, and so Mrs. Drish had him laid him in state up in the tower and encircled the coffin with candles. Well, she told her niece, Mrs. Virginia Owens Green, she moved in with her children, and she said that she wanted those candles placed around her coffin when she died. Well, Mrs. Drish died not long thereafter, and Mrs. Green couldn't find those candles. So Mrs. Drish laid in state without her candles. Now, folk wisdom tells us that you have to obey the wishes of the dear departed. And if you do not do that, severe consequences will ensue. And that's what happened in this case. There was a judge whose name was W.C. Cochran. He purchased the house in the 1880s, and he was eating dinner with his family one night, and a little boy, barged into the house and said that their house was on fire. And he said that the fire was up in the tower. Well, they ran outside, and there were no flames coming from the tower, but there were lights up there. And it was as if somebody had lit candles up in the tower. So this is how Mrs. Drish gets her revenge, by periodically turning the lights on, so to speak, in the tower and frightening people. And that is one of Tuscaloosa's most beloved ghost stories. And it does have kind of a moral, too. And a lot of ghost stories have these little hidden messages, such as honoring the wishes of the dead, which did not happen in this case.
Did they ever find the candles?
No, I don't believe so. No, I did ask the director, and no, they did not. At the time I was there, they were doing a lot of restoration. The building underwent a lot of changes over the years. They used it as a school. They even moved an auto parts store into it. And there's a famous picture from the 30s with this big tire on the front of the building and the name splashed across the side. So it's been improved on many years. And they were working on it when I was there. And a ghost hunting group had just been there, and they had done some experiments with toys. They had a stationary camera set up, video camera, and they captured a little toy truck, I guess it was, that moved across the room very slowly, but it moved. And I think that all of the structural changes they've made in the building has stirred up the spirits. This happens over and over again. A house becomes dormant, at least from a spirit sense, until people move in and start knocking down walls and laying down carpeting or whatever, and then the spirits become active. And that's what's happened with the Drish House. And it will remain active for a while, I think.
Wow.
And
there is. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Henry.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask if it's a lot of. Well, you said Greek style housing. Mm-hmm. If a lot of the housing down there with the wood and the marble, et cetera, is going to be holding on to that energy. So even if you refinish the wood, it's still going to release some of that.
Yeah, that's true. And that is one of the theories as well. That's why all these Annabella mansions, so many of the Annabella mansions are haunted. But I don't think you can underestimate all the suffering that went on in these places, too.
Oh, definitely.
Not just from the owners of the house, but from the servants or slaves. Down here, we tend to call them servants, but they were actually slaves. And I think that so much of that spiritual residue remains and has embedded itself or ingrained itself in the wood or the stone or whatever. And another thing I've noticed, and what I've read about it too, is that water seems to be a conduit mm-hmm. for spirit energy,
yes.
which is why so many of these haunted places are located on rivers or have underground rivers beneath them or that sort of thing.
You touch upon a very interesting point there, is that the owners of the property might have been very happy in their location, but the people that worked there or were indentured there probably did not.
Oh no, and there are stories about slaves. Although there aren't as many as you would think, most of the ghost stories, at least from Alabama, that involve African Americans are from the Reconstruction era. Not so much from the antebellum South, at least I haven't encountered them. I do know of some. There is a story, for example, of a little slave boy who fell in a well, and people looking in the well have seen his face looking back up at them. But see, that's not a story that deals with abuse or torture or anything like that. But there are, you do find a lot of stories about lynching, victims of lynching, especially with bridges. We've got a bridge in Sumter County that was a lynching bridge during the early part of the 20th century. And there are all kinds of ghost stories about that one.
Oh, I can't even imagine the atmosphere around that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And that particular bridge is creepy in the daytime. I took my folklore class one year, and I had two young ladies who said that they didn't like walking on it. Not just because it was creaky, it is, but they said they didn't feel right.
Is that particular bridge? Is that particular bridge still in use today?
I don't believe so. No, I know it isn't, because we couldn't cross it. There's a church right next to it, so we had to park in the church's parking lot and walk across it. A lot of these old haunted bridges are not passable anymore. But they keep them up, and I think there's a lot of community pressure. Because they are part of the community. We've got a bridge in here in Mississippi, crosses the Chunky River. Chunky's an Indian word, Choctaw word. It's actually a kind of ball game that they played. But there was a man, an outlaw named Stuckey, who had an inn. He was part of the Dalton gang. This would have been in the 1870s, and he would walk across the bridge and wave his lantern, and flatboats coming down the Chunky River would pull off and spend a night in his inn, and then he'd knock them in the head and kill them and steal from them, and there were there are at least 20 bodies buried around that bridge that they have not discovered yet. And so they eventually hanged him from the bridge. So late at night, people see that light on the bridge. People have heard his body fall from the bridge into the river. I went out there one night. Actually, it was a Halloween night. I went with a radio crew, local radio station. Boy, was that was creepy. And back then, you could drive on it, and we drove on it and stopped on it. And it's amazing how your imagination works overtime in an area like that, which is heavily wooded, very remote. I don't think we saw anything, but at the time, we were creeped out just being there.
Yeah.
For sure. And that area is known for Stuckey's Bridge. Stuckey's Bridge is one of the most famous bridges in Mississippi, and they're not preserving it, but I don't think they're going to make any effort now to tear it down. They have blocked it off, though, so you can't drive across it anymore.
I've lost it. Right. A lot of old bridges are like that. They'll block them off and still don't tear them down. So.
Right, yeah. But people still use them.
Right. Traffic.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, right. And some people use them because they have to. That's the only way they can get access to the town or whatever.
Wow.
Lots of it. Alabama's like any other southern town or southern state in that we've got all these crybaby bridges.
Yep.
They take different forms.
Yeah.
Basically the same story.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if it's pretty much the standard crybaby story.
It usually involves a pregnant girl walks across the bridge and jumps in. or she's got her baby but no husband and no prospects, and so she and the baby jump in, and so you can hear the baby crying at night. I can't tell you how many of these stories I've collected over the years. There's not a whole lot of variation.
No,
they're pretty much the same.
I was just wondering.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was saying how a lot of times when you're out in the wild, and you would think people in the down south would recognize this, but a lot of times when crybaby bridges tend to be like just the way the water is hitting the rocks, or maybe a fox crying out in the woods.
Yes, or even a loon, which makes a
makes
an eerie,
that's
cry.
That's quite a straight line.
So you're right. You're 100% correct about that. You would think they would be knowledgeable of those other ambient noises that you would hear any time out there or any place out in the woods. But again, it's the imagination that takes this hold on you, and it is fun to be scared, which is why all these teenagers go out to these places.
I sure did that in northern New Jersey, where we had a lot of urban legends and all kinds of silly things that we had to go out and check for ourselves. And
Yep, that's just a rite of passage. Always has been. Now, it's not just the South, it's everywhere.
I always thought that sometimes that would have been sort of, parents didn't want their children to go to a certain place, so they made up these stories and it backfired on them.
That's funny. That certainly could be. We've got a place in Huntsville, Cedarhurst Mansion, which was, let's see, the story goes that there was a 15-year-old girl named Sally Carter who was visiting her relatives at Cedarhurst Mansion in the 1850s, and she died for some unknown reason. And they buried her in the backyard between the owner's two babies who had died previously. Well, for years and years and years, it was a rite of passage in Huntsville for teenagers to go out with their sleeping bags and lay them on top of those graves and
Whoa.
Sleep there.
Oh, geez.
And finally, the city decided enough's enough, and exhumed the bodies and moved them to Maple Hill Cemetery. And they... they're in unmarked graves because they didn't want the teenagers to continue sleeping on top of them. I guess the director of the cemetery knows where they are, but nobody else does.
Was it a rite of passage?
Yes, certainly. And of course, you know how teenagers are. Boys would intentionally scare the girls, and the girls would hug them and get closer to them. And that's how a lot of these ghost stories are perpetuated. The young people are doing it. You know, we like to think that, this is an old story that was handed down from aged grandparents to their grandchildren sitting around the fireplace on cold winter nights. And a lot of these are. But then there are some that are generated in dormitories. College dormitories are great places to find ghosts.
Even
ghost stories. Oh, yeah.
High schools,
yes. Although, I was able to find only one haunted high school in Alabama, and that's in Decatur, Alabama. And there's no real story that goes with it. People see an amorphous white shape floating down a hallway. It's kind of a disappointment. It's the colleges that are haunted, and I think it's because colleges, for the most part, are residential. People don't live in high schools.
Right.
And as a rule, don't commit suicide in high schools. But it happens, I guess. But it happens more regularly in dormitories.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and if that's the case at my university, we had there's a story. Let's see, it's Selden Hall. And the story is that there was a girl who, one version she cut her wrists and killed herself. Another version she hanged herself. It's always room 214. And a third version, her boyfriend bludgeoned her to death and dipped his finger in the blood and wrote in the mirror, "I told you I'd come back." Turns out that story is based on fact, and I had this student in class, and it was around 2000 and summertime, and I had like four students, and she was in my American Lit class, and it's difficult to get an A in my American Lit class, but she did. She wasn't even an English major. She did. And then it turns out, I found out that the next week, I guess it was, she drank Lysol and killed herself.
Yeah, that is not a good way to go.
No, horrible way. Well, she was married, and their marriage was on the rocks, and so she killed herself. And I didn't. I really feel bad about it, but I didn't know. Nobody knew. Mm. Since then, we have gotten counselors, and so we're doing a better job helping our students with their personal problems. But that's what happened. That true story has morphed into this fanciful tale of murder or suicide or whatever. And I predict it will continue to evolve as time goes on.
Well, sure. It's a legend now. So
it's a legend now. Yes. Yep. Yes. But it was a factual story at right. one time.
And it's interesting right. if you can do the history of an urban legend and see how much has been added on over the years. It's kind of like a game of telephone.
Things
keep adding to it.
Yes. And it would be really interesting if you could actually pinpoint specific time periods when those changes occurred that might reflect social changes or whatever. Right. That might have colored the story somehow.
Well, we're going to go ahead and take us a quick break. Okay. So just remember your microphone on your phone will be live. You can just not say anything. Everything will be fine. About 3-4 minutes like that. It's not going to be real long tonight. And we'll be back. So, Jeff, why don't you take us out?
Yep, you're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with hosts Henry Foister, Ceiling Cat Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with guest author Alan Brown. So stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary dearly departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
So, Tim, around here at Para X, we're considered oldies because we've been here so long, right?
You know, yeah, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with oldies. In fact, you know what? I really love oldies.
Well, yeah, me too. I mean, it kind of takes me back to a time when my cauldron had training wheels and the Black Cat Lounge was called the Black Kitten Lounge. Sometimes I miss the good old days.
Sis, there's no need to miss them at all, because all you have to do is turn on and listen to Rock with the Shock.
Rock with the Who?
No, 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 little sis. No, 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 not the Who. The Shock.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para X.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us tonight. Those in the chat room and those from around the world. And I believe I know what all the feedback is, which I will talk to everybody in just a minute. So I want to welcome back Jeffrey.
Hello.
And Barbara.
I'm still here.
And our guest, Alan.
Me too.
Now, Alan, do you have your... Is your cell phone? Is that what it is?
No, no, I'm using the house phone.
Okay.
He's actually got a landline.
Yes. Like I said, I'm old.
Hey, landlines have their uses.
Yeah.
Of course they do.
I just thought it might have been feeding back through the cell phone, but if you're not on a cell phone, it's not feeding back through that then. So, oh well, I don't know what it is then.
And it's odd because I can't hear feedback at all.
Huh.
Well, it's not feedback as such. It's like a time lag. So
I don't even have that. Oh well.
Like I can hear. Yeah, I can hear that. I'm probably on a time lag of about 3 or 5 seconds.
Yeah. That, Jeff just goes off altogether. So.
Oh no. Stupid Skype being Skype again.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting a lot of feedback in the chat room of tonight's guest. And I wanted to let you know that you have quite a fan club developing chat room.
good, good.
One of our listeners wants you to know that your book has cost her money.
And what?
It led her to a paranormal team, causing her to get bit by the ghost hunting bug. Which led her to spending a small fortune getting her own investigative equipment. And she says to tell you thank you.
Well, good. You know, she could be spending her money on golf clubs and that sort of thing.
That's true. This is much
better. So I'm glad she's doing something that is a little more serious. Like proving the existence of a spiritual realm, which is what ghost hunters try to do.
There you are.
I was thinking about the lag. Is it kind of blows any kind of comic timing and making odd little comments? But when you indicated earlier the guy who would flag down voters to come in and bash their heads and take all their money, I'm like, and just as I was starting to think about it, and you said, well, he got hanged for it. I thought, well, at least that's one Yelp review.
Yeah, that's true.
Jeff might be some coming back feedback through your computer.
Probably not, no. Because I mute and it's still there.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, I've turned my microphone and everything else, so it shouldn't be feeding back anything through that.
There is a question from the chat room, and that is there's a bridge in West Georgia that somebody supposedly committed suicide on. Just down the road is Keys Castle, where there's an urban legend about a girl's murder. They want to know if you've ever been out to West Georgia's Devil Kitchen.
I have heard of it. I have not been there. I was in West Georgia recently, though. I went to Sonoy, Georgia in July, and that is where The Walking Dead is filmed.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and so my wife and I took the tour and everything, and they've got zombies all over the town. Even the real estate office has pictures of zombies on the window. But, yeah, I have not really done that much work in West Georgia, unfortunately. Sounds like I should, though.
Now, there's another house that's in Mobile. It's called the Richards D.A.R. House.
Yes, yeah.
They had, like, 11 children.
Yes.
With some bad stories of stuff that took place at the place, at the house. And why would you not think that the place would not be haunted? I mean, 11 children in it. So tell us about that.
Well, that's actually sometimes child ghosts are sad and heart-wrenching. I do know of one from Mississippi that is that way. But the D.A.R., Richard's D.A.R. house is just like a fun house. These kids are still, they're still mischievous. They're still laughing. You hear them laughing. You hear balls bouncing. They're still having a great time. And that house must have been chaotic when they were alive. And it kind of still is. But they did, people do get scared there. There was it involves docents. All the stories involve docents. There's a docent who, for example, got there early, walked inside, walked into the parlor. There's a man sitting on the sofa, and she was stunned, and she just stood there, and she said she knows her mouth was open. She started to say something, and he just dissipated. Slowly. Another woman, docent, pulled up early in the morning, saw a woman staring out of the bedroom window, thought it was a lady she works with, went up to the bedroom, nobody was there. Scariest thing that has happened there was maybe 10 years ago, there was a paranormal group in the bedroom in the second floor, and it was during a thunderstorm. And they were taking pictures in the room, and they got a really good orb. So just for fun, they put it on the computer and blew it up, and they saw the image of a man wearing a long coat in that orb. And the Mobile magazine ran that picture and had an account of it, of the story. So, yeah, the little kids are there, but then there are some other entities there that are adult ghosts, and they're scary. So I don't think I'd want to spend the night in the Richards D.A.R. house. Although when I was there,
did he lose his
Yeah, it was kind of fun. It didn't seem scary, really scary to me. Well, I'll tell you, another thing these kids do. There was a ghost hunting group that put a marble, a little red marble, on a pillow in the little boy's room. And they said, okay, we want you to move that marble for us. And so they left, came back about an hour, and the marble was gone. And they never have found that marble.
Wow.
It's still gone. So these kids are just, they're just little kids, mm-hmm. you know, like my kids, grandchildren. And so, but
not
but
like they're trying
there
to
are
hurt
some,
you, yeah.
Yeah, they're just trying to aggravate you, and like kids do. Now there is a ghost story from Waverly, beautiful antebellum home in West Point, Mississippi. And there was a story about the this is a mansion, beautiful mansion, stood abandoned for 60 years, and in the 1960s, and a man and woman named the Snow family purchased it, and did a lot of work renovating it. They won all kinds of awards for it. But Mrs. Snow was in the kitchen one day by herself. She had just moved in, and she heard a little girl's voice say, "Mama, Mama, Mama," and looked around, couldn't find her. A couple weeks later, she went up to the children's room, saw the imprint of a little body on the bed, and then she told me the last time she encountered that girl, she was in the kitchen, and the voice was frantic. She was just screaming, "Mama, Mama, Mama," and Mrs. Snow was it. She was just heartbroken. She said, "What can I do for you? How can I help you?" Well, it turns out that one of the young men who worked for her did some research and found out that during the Civil War there was a doctor's wife who stayed there. Her husband was went with the troops, went to war. She was there with her two little girls, and one of the little girls during the night had climbed the stair and stuck her head between the spindles in the staircase, in the banister, and got her head stuck and tried to twist her head out of it and broke her neck.
Oops.
And so they think that's the little girl that is cries at night. Mrs. Snow's daughter has heard it too and seen her. I think she has seen her as well.
Wow.
But the Snows are gone now, and it's a house museum, so I haven't heard of anyone else seeing the little girl ghost. They see other ghosts, but they haven't seen her.
Now, the Cedarhurst Mansion in Huntsville, that's an interesting story. I guess the guy's name's Ebenezer. Anybody ever heard of Ebenezer?
Yeah, one of those old 19th century names. This is the Sally Carter story. This is the Sally Carter. Well, actually, what happened was her ghost appeared at night. This would have been around the time of World War One. A young man was staying in her room, and she appeared and told him that her tombstone had blown over. And so at breakfast, he mentioned it, and his little cousins made fun of him. And so he said, "Well, let's just go outside and check." And they went out in the backyard, and the tombstone had blown over. And and so this is the place where the little kids, where the teenagers sleep on the graves.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's frustrating because it's now a gated community, and it's used as a clubhouse, and I have tried and tried to get permission to go there and have been unsuccessful. But I have talked to women who belong to that community and have told me some stories of things that have happened. That's still an active site. That house is still haunted.
Interesting. You have a couple of cemeteries in your book as well, which is kind of odd because I don't find cemetery, well, at least the ones out here, haunted at all. I'm curious as to what kind of cemetery stories are you hearing, and have you ever witnessed anything there, or have you ever felt uncomfortable there?
Well, I will say that ghost hunters love cemeteries because... a lot of ghost hunters go to them because they think, well, you don't have to get permission to go to a cemetery, and you can just go there and spend the night and whatever. Now, that's not totally true, of course. Yeah, there are places where you can get arrested for trespassing mm-hmm. in cemeteries at night. In the South, we have a lot of folk cemeteries, a lot of cemeteries in woods that have been forgotten. At one time, there was a plantation house nearby, but the plantation house has burned down or been pulled down. But the cemetery still remains, but it's overgrown and it's out in the woods. I have found, I know of two of these, and they are very, very creepy. I don't know any ghost stories from those cemeteries. I do know, I have found ghost stories, however, from city cemeteries, such as Maple Hill Cemetery in Huntsville. And that's got a, and they, most of these stories involve mausoleums. Mausoleums have always seemed particularly creepy to me because they're little houses. So there's this this suggestion that somebody's in there. And somebody lives in there. Well, of course, they're dead, but they're still there. And there's a sense of privacy. You want to leave them alone, just as you would someone else who lived in a house. But, oh, let's see. There's the Erskine, Russell Erskine Mausoleum. He was a CEO of the Studebaker Company, and he lost his fortune in the stock market crash and killed himself. And they say that you can see an angel on his door. Well, it's actually this it's discoloration of the metal. I don't know what metal, what type of metal is used in the door. But if you walk up to it, you can tell what's happened. It's some kind of corrosion that's occurred. But people want to think that it's an angel. There's another woman who, now this would have been before the Civil War. She was getting married, and she tried to whiten her skin by soaking her arms and legs and face in carbolic acid.
Yeah, wow.
Not a good idea.
Made it bone white. Oh, wait, those are the bones.
Mary Chambers Bibb, I believe, was her name, and she died in agony. And there's the story goes that they buried her sitting in a rocking chair for some reason. And so if you walk by, you can hear the rocking chair creak.
Wow.
Cool. I have not heard that rocking chair creak. I have tried it out. I try out all of these stories, and they never hold true. Close investigation.
which mansion seems to be the most haunted?
Which mansion? It's hard to choose just one. There are so many of them, and in my book, I tried to include the most famous, or at least the ones that are most famous in Alabama. I do have some favorites. I'm very fond of Gainswood and Demopolis. I think it's the most beautiful Antebellum mansion in the entire state. And it was the ghost story. This is a ghost story that does not hold up well to close scrutiny, although there are still some elements that you can't explain away. It was built in the 1850s by Nathan Bryan Whitfield. They were living on the property. They lived in a log cabin while the slaves were building the mansion. And he was an amateur architect, so he read all of these books on architecture, and I guess that's why it's such a beautiful house. Well, by the time they moved in, his wife died. But I believe she died before they moved into the house, which is a shame because she lived in a log cabin all this time and didn't get to live in her house. Well, General Whitfield had all these children. He had, I think, four or five. And so the story goes that he hired a young woman from Virginia. Her name, we don't know her first name, but her last name was Carter, came from a good family, and I believe her father was a diplomat to Italy or something like that. But anyway, so she took care of the younger children, and she became homesick, so the general sent for her sister, whose name was Evelyn, and Evelyn lightened up the place. She was very musical. She played piano, the general played bagpipes, and the little kids sang. And then one night she died. And no one knows why. Some say that she died of pneumonia from inhaling the damp air of Marengo County. Others think that she fell in love with a young lieutenant from Napoleon's vine and olive colony that was set up in Demopolis in the early 1800s. And story goes that there was an argument outside of the house, and he took her engagement ring off her finger and threw it in the bushes and left. And so she died of a broken heart. As she lay on her deathbed, she promised the general, she made the general promise that he would bury her in Virginia. She didn't want to be buried in Demopolis in Alabama. And so he promised. The problem was she died in February, and the roads were impassable. They were muddy, wet, and so he had to wait until the roads dried out before he could transport her back to Virginia. So story goes that he had the slaves carry her coffin down to the basement, down to the cellar, and they stuck it underneath the stairs, and there she remained all winter long. Well, needless to say, the slaves reported hearing footsteps going up and down the stairs at night and crying sounds from the basement. Well, when the roads dried out, the general was very pleased to get rid of her, so he had them bring her back up, and they carted her back to Virginia, thinking that the noises would stop. They did not stop. continued well into the 20th century. I interviewed an elderly woman who told me that during World War I she had a sleepover at Gainswood, and she and her little friend were up in a bedroom on the second floor, and they heard someone playing Stephen Foster songs on the piano. They ran downstairs, and not only was nobody there, but they realized that the piano didn't work anymore, that some of the keys were even missing. And this lady was adamant that this really happened to her. And I interviewed some docents for my book, and they smell flowers. They smell gardenias. One of the docents smelled them, and her son, who worked there, smelled them too. And she hadn't told him about the odors. It's interesting how ghosts manifest themselves in different ways. It seems that most ghosts manifest in sound, and which is why people hear them so often. It's rare that people catch sight of a full-bodied apparition. That's the holy grail that ghost hunters go after and try to capture on film. The ghosts also manifest themselves with smell, and so that's why in a lot of these old houses people smell cigar smoke. There's a house up in Florence, Alabama, where there's a fire in the kitchen back in the 1970s, and so people still smell smoke up in the kitchen part of that house, even though that happened over 40 years ago. So smells are interesting.
Oh, yeah. I know that tobacco residue stays around forever, but...
That is true.
Yeah, I know lilac was a very popular woman's perfume. I'm not familiar. I know rose was, too. I'm not sure about gardenia.
Yeah, I don't know why they're smelling gardenias. Unless... they had them, unless they cut the flowers in the garden and put them in vases inside the house. Mm-hmm. I don't catch that either.
Unless the family really loved gardenia.
Could be.
Flowers normally for a funeral were not necessarily just to express condolences, but the flowers were used to cover up the odor of the body before embalming. So,
and that is the reason why they have flowers at funerals. It's one of those gross reasons.
Maybe it was gardenias of the day.
That could be. It could be.
In the South, they had a lot of gardenia trees and stuff. So.
Yeah. There's another haunted house in Demopolis, Bluff Hall, which General Whitfield had built for a relative, I believe, maybe his daughter. And I interviewed the woman, her name's Kathy Leverett. She was the director of the Chamber of Commerce. And in the 1990s, she and her daughter and some friends spent the night there, and they heard a little boy crying at night. They were sleeping on pallets and sleeping bags on the first floor. They heard someone upstairs, and so Kathy walked up the stairs. All of a sudden, she stopped. She felt cold. She looked down. There's a little boy standing next to her with tears in his eyes, and she just caught sight of him for a few seconds, and he vanished. And so she went back downstairs and sat in a chair trying to make sense of what she had just seen. And she looked up and she saw him again. He was standing in front of her again, just lasted a few seconds. I told this story, I think Kathy told it, to the young man who was the director of Gainswood at the time. He did some research and found out that Confederate General Leonidas Polk had a grandchild who stayed there while his mother was having another baby in New York, and the little boy died of yellow fever, I think it was, and he was like 7 or 8. And so they still hear that little boy crying. And there's another one of those sad children ghost stories. I've not spent the night there, but I have been to Bluff Hall, and it's not nearly as fancy as Gainswood. Gainswood is a palace. They even did some special effects with mirrors. They've got these Corinthian columns inside the house, and the mirrors make it look like the room goes on and on and on into infinity, but of course it doesn't. Nice. Yeah, very nice touch. 19th day again. We're talking pre-Civil War here, so this was a man who really, really studied up on his architecture.
Now, when you find restored houses, I should say, not the restoration period. Mm-hmm. How original is the furniture in the housing as well?
Now that's a good question. Yeah. It just depends. I believe that in Gainswood, just about everything's original. But that's because the same family owned the house for generations, and then the state took it over. It's the houses where different families lived in them, or the house was broken up into apartments. Those are the ones where the furniture is gone. Some people believe that spiritual energy imprints itself on objects. And I think there might be something to that. My wife has she loves antique stores, and it creeps me out when she brings things home. because you wonder, what else has she brought home besides this music cabinet, antique music cabinet, that the door opens by itself occasionally? It just pops open. It's got a little magnet in it. And I guess maybe the magnet is not as strong as it used to be, but it's just, kind of scary to have that in your house. But I do wonder if maybe the houses that have the original furniture aren't maybe more active than the ones that don't. I don't know if you could prove that or not. Yeah. It's an interesting idea, though.
Yeah. Well, what brought it up was you're talking about the mirrors, too, and that's also one of the locations people keep saying they see ghosts is in mirrors.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you got to be careful with that. The most famous ghost mirror is in the Myrtle down in St. Francisville. Mm-hmm. I have been there. You know, people say you stare at it, you can see faces. Well, what's happened is this is a very old antique mirror, and some of the mercury on the back of the mirror has peeled off, so you've got these splotches
yeah.
in the glass. And that's what it is. There are no faces in that mirror. Mm-hmm. Now, some people might disagree with me about that.
I would worry looking in the mirror and see no face.
yes, that would be scarier. Yeah, that is true. Well, I guess if you looked, and if you focus on one of those splotches, you wouldn't see your face.
True. Well, and also the lead glass in the windows also has a really interesting effect.
It does. Well, and you've got the ripple effect on that old glass, too.
Oh, yeah.
That can play tricks with your eyes. And we've got a house here in Meridian. Meridian is only 38 miles from Alabama, which is why I live here. I carpool to Alabama. And we have an antebellum house called Mara Hope, and they have a lot of weddings are held here. And a photographer showed me a picture she had taken outside of the house, and she blew it up, and in the window you could see what she said was the face of a cat in the window. Well, I looked at it, and she planted that seed in my mind. And so when I looked at it, of course I saw the cat. But if she hadn't told me about the cat, I probably wouldn't have seen it. And it's antique glass, too. Mm. And I'm sure that accounts for that weird image.
Right. I'm going to take just a quick little break and like maybe one or two little quick messages, and then we'll come back. We're going to talk the rest about some hauntings in the colleges and some hauntations. So we'll be back in just a quick minute. So everybody stay tuned. Remember, your mics are live, so we'll be right back. Jeff, you want to take us out?
Yep. You're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with hosts Henry Foister, Ceiling Cat Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's awesome guest, author Alan Brown. So stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Parex Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us tonight, those in the chat room and those listening from around the world. And we have with us Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, hello.
And Barbara Duncan.
Hello, folks.
And speaking of those from around the world, where do we have listeners at tonight?
Henry, tonight you're listening in from the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the Netherlands.
All right. I want to welcome back Alan Brown.
Thank you.
All right. And great stories, I tell you. That's what we like to listen to. you had one of the colleges called Huntington College.
Yes.
What is the story of the Red Lady?
That is, I think that's probably Alabama's most famous college ghost story. And there are different versions of it. The one that people cling to here and tell is, again, a Catherine Tucker Windham story. And it has to do with a young woman whose name we don't know. Her name was either Martha or Margaret. I prefer Martha. That's the one that I have encountered more often. She was, this was shortly after the dormitory was built. Pratt Hall was built in 1912. And she was, she came from New York, and she was forced to attend Huntington College by her father. Her father's mother had gone there, and so he wanted his daughter to continue the tradition, and in fact told her that if she didn't go, she would not inherit his fortune. So she was compelled to go, and she was not happy there at all. And people thought that she was snobbish. She just didn't think she belonged, and she wouldn't. She ate by herself in the cafeteria. She gave the silent treatment to her roommates, and so they didn't last very long. Story goes that one day the dorm president decided that she would stay with her, room with her. Same thing happened. And Martha went out of her way to alienate herself. She wore red dresses. She had red draperies, red bedspreads. Even a red parasol. And story goes that the dorm president was packing her suitcase, and Martha walked in and said, "Oh, so you're going to leave me too. Well, I'll tell you, my dear, you will never forget this day." Well, she just, the president ignored her, took her suitcase and left. Well, her behavior became even more erratic after that. Girls said that late at night she would walk down the hallway and open the door and stand by their beds. I guess they didn't lock their doors at night. And one day the girl did not show up for classes or for meals. And so the president walked up to the fourth floor of Pratt Hall and saw this red glow come from the transom above the door. Well, she opened the door, and Martha was sprawled on the bed in a pool of blood. She had slit her wrists. Well, after that, people said that they could... that Martha's ghost still opened their doors at night while they were sleeping. They would see the red glow come from the from her room. And I did interview a woman whose daughter was in band camp, and she spent the night on the fourth floor. And this would have been the late 1970s, and she saw that red light come from the transom. Well, dormitory now is used, let's see, I think it's used as a classroom space. The fourth floor is used as the offices for social sororities. And every year, Huntington College has what they call a Red Lady Run, where the girls dress up in red and have races, which is kind of funny.
That's odd.
It is odd, yes. It is odd. But there's another ghost that doesn't get any...
Celebrating suicide.
Yeah, his name's Frank, and he owns the library. And we don't know anything about him at all. He's a poltergeist-like spirit. So I guess the librarians and the work studies who work in the library just chose that name for him. But he leaves books open on the tables. He slams the doors, pushes books off the shelves, that sort of thing. But that's a kind of secondary ghost that you don't really hear about or know about unless you do a lot of research. So it's fun to uncover those, too.
There's a question from the chat room, and they want to know about that red glow and if anyone said why it was noticed when she was found.
Now, that is a very good question. And I have not heard any theories as to that. It really doesn't make sense, does it? Why would there be a red? Why would there be any light when she dies? Unless, I don't know, is that her spirit leaving her body? Who knows? I don't have any explanation for it. And there, I guess maybe you can overthink these things. Once again, this is a. The version I just told you is the one, the literary version. Ms. Windham did add some literary flourishes to her accounts of these tales that she had heard when she went to Huntington College. So I don't know if that's something she added or not. It would be, I guess, useful to go back and try to find other oral versions of the tale and compare them. See if that red glow is still there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's the evolution of the urban legend story.
Yes, right. And that is I've looked at college ghost stories from all over the South, and I've never encountered one like that. That's not to say they're not there. I just haven't run into any other red ladies. In fact, most female ghosts wear white. Mm-hmm. No one really knows why.
Hmm.
White or black? Black if they're in mourning, but most female ghosts are white. So the whole red thing is kind of unique to Alabama.
Yeah, the red glow thing too, yeah.
Yep.
You had one about the University of West Alabama. It had burned down twice and been rebuilt three times.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's the story that I told about George Snow seeing the ghost in the hallway. Yeah, and there's some other stories connected with it, though, and I got one of them I got from students. We have a couple I got from students. I had a work study. Well, she wasn't my work study. She was a work study who worked in Webb Hall, and she told me that she had gone on one of my ghost tours, and so she got some of her little friends to go over to the second floor where George Snow had his experience, and they took a Ouija board with them. And I do not recommend that you mess with Ouija boards. Some people think they open up portals. And nasty stuff can come through those portals, so don't mess with them. But she did, and asked the spirit her name, and the spirit said Mary, and asked her if she was happy, and the spirit said no, and then asked her if she was going to stay in the building, the spirit said yes, and then didn't say anything more. I talked to another student who was an escort. We have, actually, it's a pretty nice program where female students who, like, let's say, work in the library or studying in the library late at night and have to walk across campus to their dormitories, they can call the physical plant, and they will contact some young man who will escort them across campus. And this one couple was walking past Webb Hall, and they looked up and saw a blonde girl staring out the window at them. And there was nobody in there at the time. So that's one of those. I think Webb Hall is definitely one of the most haunted places. The library is probably the haunted place, most haunted place. And I even did an overnight investigation there one time. And I didn't get anything. Nothing happened to me. But we had some ghost hunters with us, and they got some EVPs that were kind of interesting. But it was built in 1960. One of the ugliest buildings on campus. It looks like a cracker box.
Wow.
It really is. Well, the hauntings began in 1996, and they began in May of 1996. I had a student who was a veteran of the Persian Gulf War, Ray Jordan. And Ray told me that he was studying for a psych final, and he had squirreled himself away back in one of the cubby holes in the library, and he fell asleep. And he woke up just enough time to see the lights going off one at a time. And so he ran to the door. Well, the door was locked, and he saw the librarian drive away. He didn't know where the light switch was. He was in the darkness. So he went up to the circulation desk, called up the physical plant security, said they'd send over somebody to let him out. So Ray sat in the chair, just trying to forget where he was. And he said that, now we have some street lights in front of a library, and in the glow of one of the lights, faint glow, he said he saw a woman walk up and down the stacks. Well, that freaked him out. So he ran to the back office, and he said he just stood there. He was riveted to the spot, and then he felt cold. He said he felt, you know how you can tell if somebody's looking over your shoulder? He said he felt somebody standing behind him. So Ray said he ran back to the circulation desk, jumped over it. Now, Ray is a short guy. He's a short guy. He jumped over it and ran to the front door and sat down. Well, security guard came by, looked down at him, opened the door, and said, "You've seen the ghost, haven't you?" Turns out the security guard was in the habit of going in there and sitting just inside the front door on a sofa, and he'd read newspapers at night, around 2 or 3 in the morning. And he told me that one night, I was reading a newspaper. He looked up at the glass door, and in the reflection of the glass door, he could see a woman standing behind him. And he took off and got out of there in a hurry. I met him at Walmart maybe 3 or 4 years later. I told him that I put his ghost story on my ghost tour, and he got really serious, and he said, "I still have nightmares about that." And just about every librarian that's ever worked there has had experiences. We have a night librarian, works there from 9 to 11. Her name is Becky Babb, and Becky said that she was, one night she was there about getting ready to close up, and she felt fingers run across her shoulders and down her arm. I can't think of anything scarier than physical contact with, and they were cold fingers too, of course, icy cold fingers. Librarians have heard their names called. Becky said the scariest thing that happened to her was that it was about 10 to 11, getting ready to close up, and she heard a noise she had never heard before. It was a squeak, squeak, squeak sound, and it was coming from the second floor. So she walked up the stairs. She was on the landing, looked up, and There was an antique wheelchair that had wheeled itself out of the conference room and was perched right at the top of the stairs. Looks like it was going to fall down. Well, she was terrified, so she ran down the stairs, turned off the lights, went home. Well, during the night, she realized that she probably should have pushed that chair away from the stairs. So she got there early, went up the stairs, and the chair was back in the wheelchair. She called security and asked them if they had pushed it back in there. They said no. They had not done that. I talked to the head librarian about it, and he said that we have a portrait of a woman who was the principal of the laboratory school, and her picture is hanging in the library. Well, about 15 years ago, they moved a portrait of the man who would have been her boss, a provost, and put him in the library, and apparently, notices the librarian slant on it. She is angry because his portrait is now in the same building as hers is, and so she expresses her displeasure through all these poltergeist-like things that happen. Now, again, that sounds a, I don't know.
Yeah,
it sounds a bit imaginative, but
a bit.
It's a good story.
I was going to ask you
now,
what was going on in the library before that. It doesn't sound like there was any.
No, there was.
Yeah.
No, and see that's why the head librarian said it was. See, it was 1996 when they moved that man's portrait into the library, so he sees some kind of connection there between his portrait and the activities.
Wow.
So, I don't know if there's a connection or not. But, yeah, nothing. Well, I've been there since 1986, and I hadn't heard anything, any stories, until Ray told me his.
Now, our time is running by real quick, and I got a whole page full yet of stuff that we're not even going to come close to getting to. So I'm just going to jump to a couple of them that I think is pretty interesting. You have one about the story of Huggin' Molly. What is Huggin' Molly?
it's in the wiregrass country of Alabama. It's down south. It's the southeast part of Alabama. And when you drive into Abbeville, they have this big, I don't know, it looks kind of like a plaster sign. It says, "Welcome to Abbeville," and it shows this little boy being chased by this huge witch-like creature. So that's what you see when you drive into Abbeville. Huggin' Molly is supposed to be 7 feet tall, and she'll squeeze children if they're out late at night. Now, obviously, this was created by parents or grandparents to keep children inside the house before it got dark. But there are interviews with, I have not talked to anybody, but I have found interviews with people who said that they encountered her when they were young. And she scared the heck out of them, and they took off running. There is a restaurant called Huggin' Molly's, which is very popular. When I went there, unfortunately, it was closed, and I didn't get to eat at Huggin' Molly's. I did get a picture of it, though. But she's kind of like a female boogeyman, in a sense. I guess sometimes one of the ways to discipline children back then was to scare them into being good. And that's certainly true of this case.
Wow.
So you don't, I don't think say your name three times in a mirror?
No. No, you don't. But I'm sure that you will find her counterparts all over the world.
Oh, I don't doubt it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you get...
She just happens to be Alabama's version, but I'm sure other states probably have some, too.
There's another one that I thought was pretty interesting. It was a real old hotel, and it was changed into a lot of other stuff before it was restored again. But it also has history and ghosts. And the one famous ghost that I thought was pretty interesting, it's called the St. James Hotel in Selma.
The ghost is
Jesse James.
Yeah, Jesse James had relatives. James Brothers had relatives in Selma. And they came here. They came to Selma in 1881. And the St. James Hotel, very old, it was built 1837, I think. It survived the Civil War only because it was used as a barracks by Union soldiers. The Union Army pretty much burned down Selma during the Civil War. They had the Briar Works iron factory there where they made munitions, and so it was a prime target. But the St. James Hotel is haunted probably by, not just by Jesse James. Now, he has been seen. He's been seen in rooms, let me see, 214, 314, and 315. He's described as a tall, rugged-looking cowboy. He wears spurs. They hear them jingling at night. But apparently his dog haunts it, too. They hear him barking. And he had a girlfriend whose name was Lucinda, and she has been seen floating around the hotel. So Jesse James seems to be the primary spirit in that house. And people who work there and guests encounter him occasionally. And I think it's highly unusual that you would find an outlaw's ghost like him in Alabama. You would expect him to be in Missouri, not Alabama. He's apparently is still here. He also robbed the paymaster up in Huntsville, too. That was his big robbery in Alabama.
Alabama.
Yeah, yep.
Now, you got one. It has a lot of different variations about the ghost or about the story about the ghost. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Pickens County Courthouse.
That is Alabama's most famous ghost story.
Ah.
Yes, it is. I'm glad you brought it up. I was waiting for you to bring it up. In fact, I am sitting in my basement staring at a picture that my wife took of the Pickens County Courthouse, the face in the window. She told me she took 20 pictures of it before she got this one. And it's such a good picture that Joe Nickel from the Skeptical Inquirer, he had seen it somewhere, probably in one of my books, and he wanted a copy of it. So I had a print made of it and sent it to him. And he used it. Story goes that in 1865, a Union General John T. Croxton, who also burned down the University of Alabama on April 3rd and 4th, he came to Carrollton, Alabama, and burned down the courthouse. Well, the people pulled together their resources, and they erected another structure out of wood. And in 1876, the unthinkable happened. It burned down again. Well, the populace wanted justice. They wanted to pin it on somebody. So the sheriff decided to blame a mean-spirited black man whose name was Henry Wells. Henry was no fool. He found out about it, and he took off. He was gone for 2 years. And then he received word that his grandmother was deathly ill. So he returned to Carrollton under the cloak of darkness, and the sheriff was waiting for him, and he captured him and took him to the courthouse and locked him up in the garret, very top. Well, during the evening, Henry was looking out the window, and he saw a couple of men standing on the ground, looking up at him. And then the crowd got bigger and bigger, and then he noticed one of them had a rope, and he knew what was going on. And so he said, "If you hang me, I will be with you always. I am an innocent man." Well, they couldn't hear him because he was in the garret. So they ran up the stairs, dragged him down, and lynched him from a pecan tree in front of the building. Well, the next morning, a couple of members of the lynch mob were walking by the courthouse, and they looked up, and one guy nudged his friend and said, "Hey, isn't that the guy we just lynched yesterday?" And he said, "It sure is." He was looking down at him. So they ran upstairs. There's nobody up there. Nobody was there. Story goes that the sheriff tried to have the face removed with steel brushes and soap and water, and it wouldn't come off. There's another story that a hailstorm in 1920 broke every window except that one. And there's another in another version they replaced the window and the face came back. Well, the face is there, and I guess the people in the courthouse got tired of visitors asking them where's the face in the window, so they put a piece of wood with a black arrow on it pointing to the pane of glass that has the face in it. And they also, this is fairly recently, they have erected a telescope. So you can stand on a street corner and look up and you can see it. Now, it looks like a smiley face to me. It does not look like a real human face, but it has the features of a face. It is so well known that Ripley, you know, Ripley's Believe It or Not, he wrote about it. Ghost hunting groups have spent the night inside the courthouse. It's no longer a courthouse now. It's a museum. They have spent the night there, and I think they've had various experiences. Now, there are, during the 1930s, the WPA hired people to collect folktales from rural areas, and in some of these folktales, it's not Henry Wells, it's his partner, whose name was Burkhalter, and he was the one who was lynched. Oh, I've got, now I've interviewed people from the that area, from Carrollton, who have told me that, an African-American lady told me that Henry Wells was accused of raping a white woman. And so that's why he was lynched. So you do see different versions from different ethnic groups and racial groups. Even though it's the same basic story, the elements are different. And that's why I put all those different versions in my book, because I thought it really spoke to how folk tales are transmitted.
Sure.
Especially when you have different racial groups that live contiguously to each other, which is what's happened in the South, of course, for generations.
Has anybody matched up, if there's a known photograph of this gentleman with the picture?
I don't believe so. No. The fact that the details are very, very sketchy. There was a bounty hunter who probably provided, I think, the most accurate period account of it. And he claimed to have captured Burkhalter and Henry Wells. And he interviewed them, and Burkhalter said that Henry burned down the courthouse because of their indictment papers that were kept there. And as the bounty hunter was, his name was Honeycutt, by the way, as Honeycutt was apprehending them, he shot Henry, and Henry later died of his wounds. So it now appears that it's actually Burkhalter, but Burkhalter was not lynched. So we don't really know all of the facts in this case. Once again, the version that most Alabamians pass down now is Captain Tucker Windham's version, which is the one that I told you.
Wow. Well, we're down to just about 6 minutes left, if that much. But just for a couple of minutes, I'd like to talk about this one that we've had a famous place where I know lots of different people has gone to investigate, and we've had people from Parex go down there. I've always wanted to go but never made it, and that's Sloss Furnace.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You've got to be careful with Sloss Furnace with their stories because they're one of the ghosts, I guess the ghost story that you hear the most often is fabricated. It's probably apocryphal. The story goes that there was a foreman whose name was Slag Wormwood, who was really mean to everybody, and he would push people down the stairs if they didn't move fast enough, and finally the guys who worked for him got sick of it and pushed him into one of the furnaces, and so his ghost actually pushes people down the metal stairs as they're walking. There is no proof to that story. I've not found any. And I have, I've interviewed people at Sloss Furnaces, and they have told me that they don't know where that story came from. But they have, during Halloween, they have a haunted house there. They call it the Sloss Fright Furnace. Brings in a lot of money. You can't imagine how many people go to that event. And a lot of people did die. In fact, 67 people died there. Most of them died from falling into the molten iron. Most famous example, 1887, and there's a newspaper from the Birmingham Herald Age, a newspaper article about a guy named Calvin Theophilus Jowers, foreman, who worked at the Alice No. 1 furnace, and he was in charge of this crew that was taking the bell off the furnace, and they're going to lower it into the furnace and melt it and replace it with a new bell. Well, Calvin had a hold of the rope. He slipped, and the bell fell into the furnace, and he fell on top of the bell, and he was incinerated. They put they got this pipe and a piece of sheet metal and lowered it down, and they were able to retrieve his head, his bowels, and a foot. And his ghost has been seen in the shimmering heat. People have felt a reassuring hand on their shoulder. He loved his job, and so he's still on the job, apparently. Now, there are I think it's probably safe to say that most of the people who died there were African-Americans. They were no workman's comp, no safety procedures were put in line because it was easy to replace people. And so a lot of them fell into the furnaces as well.
It's apparently a very easy way to fire them, too.
Well, you sure.
More like melt them.
Yeah, easy to get rid of them. Hard jobs are hard to come by. So if you complained, you got fired. They have, at Sloss Furnaces, they have a really good archives where they have oral histories from people who've worked there. One guy said that during the wintertime, you're frozen on one side and you're burned on the other side because it was so cold in there, cold and hot working in there. Sloss, I think it probably is haunted because of all the misery there. Without a doubt.
That's what I would think, too.
A lot of ghost hunters, a lot of television ghost hunting groups have been there.
Oh, yes.
And they all collect evidence.
Yep.
Haven't you been there, Henry?
No, I've always wanted to go. I didn't get a chance to go. Dave and Tom and all those went down, and I think there was tornadoes and stuff on their way back, so I didn't get to go. Got one quick one that you can probably talk just a minute or two about before we have to wrap up. And it's called the Boynton Oak. It's a cute little story.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll try to tell that one quickly. Takes place around 1835 in Mobile. There was a printer named Charles Boynton, who was accused of murdering his roommate, whose body was found in the cemetery. And there's circumstantial evidence that convicted him. And the story goes that on the day he was to be hanged, he said that he proclaimed his innocence and said that he would return as proof of his innocence somehow. Well, after he died, they buried him in a potter's field across from the cemetery, and a giant oak tree grew from it. And it's still there. It's called the Boynton Oak. I went there, and I've been there a couple of times, got a picture of it in my book. And there is a legend that when he died, before he was lynched, he had some acorns that he put in his pockets of his pants to make sure that the oak tree would grow. We don't know for sure. But it's the most famous haunted tree in Alabama, without a doubt. Yep.
Told them they all didn't have the right person, and an oak tree would grow out of my grave just to prove
yep.
it.
Yep, and it has. And the neat thing about Mobile is that people go there. For years, they have gone to the cemeteries and had picnics. And they still do it. I believe they still do it in Mobile. And that's how these cemetery stories get spread. And I think that's why that particular story has lasted so long. And the fact that that massive oak tree is still there, too.
Yeah, I used to have a aunt and uncle that lived in Mobile many years ago. So I got to go there once as a little kid, young kid. So, yeah. But anyway, time has just slipped right on by. I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight. Great stories. And I think everybody in the chat room just enjoyed them also. What I want you to do is let everybody know where they can get your books. And you're not on social media, so they can't really follow you. But they can get your books and stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Well, my books are available on Amazon. My first name is A-L-A-N, not A-L-L-E-N, A-L-A-N Brown. Most of my books have been published by the History/Arcadia Press. So if you log onto their website, you can get them there. You can, as I say, get them from Amazon. I believe you can get them digitally as well. Now, The Haunting of Alabama that I've just been talking about, that was published by the Pelican Press in Gretna, Louisiana last year. And
it's on Amazon, but it's not quite listed with the rest of your books. But on the report page, I'll have a link of I've found at least 22 titles I've linked.
Thank you very much. Very good. I actually feel kind of ashamed that I haven't done it myself, but like I say, I'm busy writing all these things.
we want you to stay on for a few minutes until after we're off, and then we will talk with you for a minute or two. So our time is run out. We will be with you again next week, and we have Kayla Ambrose with us with her book, The Awakened Dreamer. So, very interesting book. So, with that, I'm going to let everybody say good night. So, this is Henry Foister,
Jeffrey Gould,
and Barbara Duncan.
And we will see you next week at the same time. So, good night, everybody.